From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Today, we begin a new feature on News and Notes. In fact, we call it Newcomers to News and Notes, and that's exactly what it is. We're highlighting some of the brightest new young voices of journalism, and we're bringing them to you. We begin with the story of one California community where people are actually learning how to talk in an ever-changing work environment. Here's Janae Darden.
Señor el presidente.
Señor el presidente. Three nights a week, students in Inglewood, California bring their dictionaries, notebooks, and eagerness to a tiny community center to learn Spanish. Tonight, there are seven students, all of them African American, most over 40 years old. Postal worker Rochelle Mitchell has been coming since the classes began last summer. The increased number of Latinos in her community is one of the reasons why she signed up.
I just want to know basically how to speak it, but I also want to know what they're saying. I want to know if they're talking about me and what they're talking about.
But what also keeps Rochelle and her classmates engaged is the course's Afrocentric angle.
You have to have a connection.
Idris Aziz is the instructor. He speaks Spanish, French, and Arabic. But he says some Black people reject learning a foreign language because they don't realize the bigger connection.
It piques an interest to know that there are people in other countries that run those countries and they look like Uncle Willie, but for the fact that they just don't speak the language.
So Aziz keeps students interested by showing there's a Black presence in Latin American culture, like when he gives a mini history lesson on a major Los Angeles street, Pico Boulevard.
This guy was a governor. Pico. And he was what they call a mestizo, which means he was of mixed race. I'm just telling you, it's just the history.
40% of California households speak more than one language, and that becomes more evident in the workplace. Educator Carlos McGee saw a need for Blacks to learn Spanish and hired Mr. Aziz to help launch the class through her literary program, Chocolate Keepsake.
We were not put here to be separated in the way in which many of us have operated over the years. And Spanish is one of those places where I see we can bridge the divide.
The need for bilingual workers is becoming more common, but Rochelle Mitchell isn't complaining. She practices her Spanish with coworkers.
They're the majority, so we might as well just get with the program. And I feel like the world is changing, so you have to change with it.
Carlos McGee and Idris Aziz hope to expand the Afrocentric Spanish class, which already has a growing wait list. For NPR News, I'm Janae Darden in Los Angeles.
And I'm joined now in studio by Janae Darden. Welcome to News and Notes.
Hey, Tony.
Nice piece. Were you surprised to find that there were people trying to learn another language at their age and in that community?
I was surprised because there were people, as I said in the piece, in their 40s, and I even saw grandparents in there, and especially because we hear so much about the Black and brown tensions in L.A. and Southern California, so it's nice to see that there are people trying to bridge that divide.
Did you get a sense whether this is difficult for them? I don't know if learning a language at age 40 and beyond is harder or easier.
Well, that was another thing that surprised me. They really picked it up. Mr. Aziz's teaching style is incredible. He's really just eccentric with his teaching style, and they really pick it up, and he speaks to them. You know, he makes jokes, and he really incorporates Black culture when he's teaching the language. Like we were talking, he was talking about Playa del Rey, which is a city here in Southern California, and some people were saying Playa del Rey, and he said, ain't no players up in here, and you know, and that gets the people engaged, but they've really picked up the language, really picked it up, and they say age isn't an issue for them.
Well, that's great. You did a nice job.
Thank you.
Let's move on now to our reporters' roundtable. There's more bad news coming out of the economic sector. New numbers show that the economy continues to shrink to record levels as consumer spending and business investment ground almost to a halt. The stimulus package passes the House, but with no GOP votes. Will the bill get bipartisan support when it goes to the Senate next week? And Illinois has a new governor as the state Senate ousts Rod Blagojevich on a unanimous vote. So joining us for today's Reporters Roundtable are Mark Caputo, a state policy and politics reporter for the Miami Herald, Callie Crossley, a commentator and a regular panelist for WGBH-TV's media criticism program, Beat the Press, and we are adding our own News and Notes newcomer, Janae Darden, to the discussion as well. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Hey.
Let's begin with this. The latest numbers show that the gross domestic product shrank 3.8% in the fourth quarter of 2008, the lowest it's been in nearly 30 years. Unemployment rate still going up. Callie, you just heard Janae's piece on workers learning a new language to sharpen their skill set. Are you seeing anything along those retraining trends in the Boston area?
Absolutely, but we're not seeing enough of it, Tony, and that's the point. We've lost manufacturing jobs. We've heard that with the bad statistics, and a lot of jobs have gone overseas, and some of those jobs have gone overseas because those folks are really trained in high tech. We need retraining of American workers for the 21st century, and it's all about learning new skills, whether they be tech skills, whether they be language skills. It's about upgrading your skills.
I would think, Mark, that in Florida, particularly in South Florida, the language issue would be a big one.
Well, yeah, it's big. Just as everyone started to learn Spanish, then came a huge influx of Haitian refugees and settlers, so to speak. And so now we not only have Spanish as a majorly spoken language, but also Creole as well. And most studies show, and the statistics show, is that as the economy declines, enrollment in schools of all sorts increases, and that is what we're seeing. But Florida's been kind of a canary in the coal mine as far as the badness of the national economy, and we're in particularly rough shape. California beat us out for total job loss over the entire year, but I still think we're at about 255,000 jobs lost in a year's worth of time.
Well, you know, just today the president is dealing with some executive orders, issuing them to help in the workplace, specifically dealing with organizing labor unions. Callie, I'm going to come back to you. These new orders, what do they mean exactly for union and non-union workers?
Well, I think it means that, you know, there's some recognition that they have a role to play and that each one of us in this economy has a role to play. I mean, what we have seen, if we didn't understand it before, is this domino effect and how we're all connected. So if we look at labor as a central piece of that, then we understand that we have got to pay attention to what's important for those folks who are in those unions. And we're looking at the losses at all of these jobs. And frankly, it's scary. Just even if you're a person with a job, you're looking at that. Even if you're a person not in a union, you understand what that means.
Well, you know, Janae, you're a young person just coming into the job market. Two things. One is, do you concern yourself with whether there is unionization on a job that you might pursue? And secondly, in terms of the people that you saw at this class, I know it was about language, but was there any sense that these people are part of a union? Maybe the union was paying for them to take the class, something like that?
I definitely didn't get a sense of that. I'm not sure if anybody was part of the union. And definitely when you're looking at work, and especially in broadcast journalism, you do want to look at unions because they do provide those services and protection.
Do you have a sense, Mark, at all whether or not these orders signed by the new president will have a positive or negative effect in terms of trade unionism in the workplace?
Well, I doubt there's going to be much help for unions in Florida because we're a southern state, and as part of Roosevelt's compromise with the New Deal, we're a right-to-work state, so we have very few unions here. The unions we do have don't have much in the way of teeth except for police and fire. So as far as any sort of big labor movement helping, not much of it. We're kind of a service-based state. The little manufacturing we have here is almost completely gone.
Well, particularly in manufacturing, auto manufacturing comes to mind, Callie. The issue of whether to have trade unionism has been one that's sort of split the workplace, to be quite honest about it. The sense, though, that one might get from listening to the new president is that he is in favor of supporting unions in the workplace.
I think if you ask your average person, what people don't like is what they perceive to be certain kind of unnecessary benefits that are accrued to unions. I mean, a lot of folks don't go back to the history of how the unions came to be in terms of protecting workers' rights and making sure that they were not abused in the workplace. And so what they see sometimes is, somebody can't work for 5 hours and somebody gets paid, double time for lifting up a switch. And people are like, hello, I need a job. And this is what you're arguing about? But that's not really what the unions came to be. They were there to protect workers around health care. They were around hours of work, all of those kinds of things. And I think if there can be some coming together of both union leaders and organization and organizers with folks in some way that understands the reality that we are in right now, then I think you'll find a lot more support for unions, even though there have been those situations where they have been split down the middle in workplaces.
You know, the irony of this is that President Obama has likened himself to some policies of Ronald Reagan, that he did this during the campaign. And Ronald Reagan, though, when, in terms of unionism, although he was the former head of the Screen Actors Guild at one time in his career, was known for breaking the union, particularly the air traffic controller. So there is sort of an irony in those two different positions, wouldn't you say, Mark, really briefly?
Well, I would in that respect, but what Obama was talking about is that he's and maybe he didn't intend it or who knows, but he is kind of one of those transformational figures the way Reagan was. And remember, Reagan's big thing, government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem. Now we're hearing that government is the solution to the problem. So we're coming around.
Come
maybe
full
360
circle.
Or 180 or who knows what the degrees are.
Absolutely. Let me ask you all to just hold on for a second. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to continue this conversation in just a few moments. This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back now with our Reporters Roundtable. With us today, Mark Caputo, a state policy and politics reporter for the Miami Herald, Callie Crossley, a commentator and a regular panelist for WGBH-TV's media criticism program, Beat the Press, and Janae Darden, a freelance reporter based here in Los Angeles, and she's our News and Notes newcomer. So let's get back to the topic of the stimulus for a moment, if we can, because the House passed a $900 billion rescue bill. But the Republicans, Callie, they were like, no, 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 no.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are characterizing this as a defeat for President Obama since he, you know, to many people's eyes, went out of his way to extend the olive branch, to bring in the Republicans, to talk to them, to explain his position, blah, blah, blah. But I don't see it that way. I actually see it as just a setback. He's laying the groundwork for a longer relationship. He's understanding that some of those people have ideological differences, and he's understanding that some of them just want to make political posturing right now important for them. They want to be on stage with that. But I'm reminded of Willie Jolly's statement that a setback is a setup for a comeback. So I think he's coming back.
That's an interesting
And when he comes
point.
Back, that I think he will be bringing all that he has done in working with those relationships, and I think eventually there will be some movement on their side.
Well, you know, Janae, the president has made a great deal of his bipartisan attempts. Do you feel that there is a chance that he'll be able to cross the aisle and get both parties to work together?
I do think so, especially with just the nature of the economy. And I know people on the right and on the left are expecting their politicians to come through for them and help them out. And I'm not surprised about what happened tomorrow. I mean, what Callie said is definitely looking at ideology. And for the Republicans, they thought the package involved too much spending, and that's part of the Republican platform, you know, not as much spending and more tax cuts. And so I guess they felt that Obama's stimulus package didn't bring that.
Well, let's talk about Florida, Mark, where you are. Normally that's a red state, although it's a red state that went for Obama this time. But the Republicans there, does this play well with them when the party sort of stands on ideological ground and blocking a stimulus package that is intended to help everybody, both Democrats and Republicans alike?
Well, there's a split. If you're a Washington Republican, you're against this. If you are a state legislative Republican, including Republican Governor Charlie Crist, who might have been, was on McCain's shortlist to be vice president, you want the stimulus package. There is an ideological problem, though, in that states such as Florida, which are not allowed to deficit spend, are being told in the stimulus package, look, if you want money, you have to roll back the clock and spend as much health and education money as you spent in 2006 as you are now. We don't care if you've cut spending or spent your money wisely or, you know, been careful. And so there's a little bit of conflict there, and the state is trying to cure that as an issue because Florida's saying, look, we're basically just out of money. Now, if you want us to raise taxes, well, we might have to do that, albeit it'll probably be cigarette taxes. But you are seeing a split. If you're in Washington and you're a Republican, yeah, you're going to be against this. And it's kind of a free vote anyway. It's early in Obama's term. The, you know, midterm elections are quite a bit away. And, you know, voting against it, there's no real harm, at least not right now. politically there might be a bit, but there's ample time for a do-over.
For them to do over. Let's talk about the mortgage giant Freddie Mac announcing today that it's going to let homeowners and tenants stay in homes that are in foreclosure, at least for a while. Fannie Mae did something similar earlier this month. The program is designed to let qualified tenants lease the foreclosed property from Freddie Mac to keep as many as 8,600 families with a roof over their heads. Does this sound like a good idea to you, Callie?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't care if it's a drop in the bucket. Somebody's got to start doing this. This is the root of the problem we're in right now. And so much of this discussion, even about the stimulus package, everything is still not going to those people who are struggling to keep their homes. So anything right now that it looks like that'll give people a reprieve, I think is a good thing.
I would think that in Florida, Mark, that the home foreclosure crisis has hit particularly hard.
We're number two in home foreclosures. This is certainly welcome news. I guess the only thing is what took so long? And the other thing is that this is purely pragmatic. I mean, where are people going to go? You know, we don't have a lot of money in the state to enforce a lot of things as it is. Are you going to task sheriff's offices all the time with evicting people? I mean, it makes more sense to just kind of come back to the renegotiating table and say, okay, folks, you can't pay. How much can you pay? At least give us something.
And at the same
and
time.
And to Mark's point, you know, ahead. I have to say, Tony, to Mark's point, I could never understand what do banks want to do with all this property? I
mean, they don't want it.
They can't. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. to one more thing in Florida before we move on to our last topic, Mark, it's the State Farm Insurance announcing this week that it wants to get out of the home insurance business in Florida, a place that's hit by hurricanes and other sorts of natural disasters. That cannot come as good news.
It's not. There's an interesting political situation there. Governor Charlie Crist has a very nice guy style. Even when he was running mate with McCain, he only said nice things about Obama, or better said, potential running mate. But he has gone out of his way for more than 2 years to demonize State Farm. And there was an insurance reform package that was passed, which State Farm greatly dislikes in Florida, essentially puts more government into the game. And they finally said, oh, forget it, we're going to walk away. Now, whether it's a political ploy or whether it's real talk, we'll see. But you're going to see some interesting changes in the way in which a Republican-controlled legislature has to handle a big issue like, say, homeowners insurance by putting more government into the game.
Let's end the conversation with this. The theater of the absurd, which I think is a fair way of describing what's going on in the state of Illinois with the ouster of Rod Blagojevich, Janae Darden. What do you say?
I'm not surprised. It is crazy. It's insane. You know, especially since everybody voted against him, but I'm not surprised.
It was unanimous. Did you think it was going to be unanimous, Kelly? I was watching as they were casting their votes, and a couple of legislators, they were like, okay, I'm voting no, but I'm going to go slow in terms of pushing that no button.
I'm not surprised it was unanimous. What I am surprised is a few of them said there was overwhelming evidence. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't know. What I've heard so far, you know, where's the smoking gun? There's a lot of threats and nasty stuff, and he doesn't look good. But, you know, I haven't actually heard him say, okay, I'm taking the $100,000 now. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
It would definitely be that. They've already taken. They couldn't wait to get his pictures off the buildings and off the walls in the state capitol in Illinois, Mark. But like to Callie's point, you know, you can't go into a court of law and convict somebody on the evidence that they've presented so far, can you?
Well, there's a difference here in that this is kind of a civil and political matter. And the fact is that he was essentially unable to govern. Incidentally, we do have a little Florida story today. Today, the Speaker of the Florida House temporarily resigned his job amid a criminal probe into the way he accepted a community college job after steering millions of dollars to it. There's a few other associated allegations. So it's not isolated to Illinois, although they really have an interesting history of electing allegedly corrupt politicians, if not corrupt ones. But, you see that this House Speaker we had here, Ray Sansom, said, essentially, I can't govern because I have to focus on my criminal trial. Well, it's the same thing with Blagojevich there. He essentially couldn't govern, even if he's innocent of everything. He just couldn't govern under these circumstances, especially if he's going to attend The View and, you know, Diane Sawyer and who knows.
Absolutely. Well, we'll find out how his successor, Pat Quinn, whom folks don't know a great deal about, but I'm assuming that in the days and weeks and months ahead, there will be a lot more to find out about him. State of Illinois, what an interesting place for politics. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thank you all very much. A really good roundtable today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mark Caputo is a state policy and politics reporter for the Miami Herald. Callie Crossley is a commentator and a regular panelist for WGBH-TV's media criticism program, Beat the Press. She joined us from the WGBH Studios in Boston. And Janae Darden is a freelance reporter based here in Los Angeles. She also writes a blog at cocofly.blogspot.com, and she is our very own brand new News and Notes newcomer. She joined me here in the studios of NPR West. If it bleeds, it leads. Why does crime, death, and destruction often get top billing in the news? How do journalists report on violence and tragedy with sensitivity and balance? And what does covering crime all the time do to them and their psyches? We continue our crime series now with a look at how the media deal with crime inside and out. Let's start with the reporters who have covered murder and mayhem as part of their beats. Michelle McCallop, a former crime reporter with KBMT Channel 12 in Beaumont, Texas, is joining us. And Natalie Pompilio, a freelance journalist who has covered crime, war, and natural disasters for 15 years in New Orleans and Iraq and now at her current base of Philadelphia. Welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Hi, Tony.
Young reporters are almost always assigned the police beat when they start out. Is that what happened to the both of you, Michelle?
Yes, pretty much. I mean, I've done newspapers in Grand Rapids and Muskegon, Michigan, and typically in the newsroom you get assigned to the police beat, at least. I think we had a rotating position for that. And when it comes to news, TV news, that's what makes the news, really. Any kind of overnight murder or overnight crime, people are interested in what's happening, especially in their neighborhood.
That's true. Natalie, is that what happened to you? You got stuck on the, I won't say stuck, you got put on the police beat when you got started?
I actually begged for the police beat.
Did you?
I started covering local governments, and I couldn't believe how boring I found that. And I really, really wanted to cover crime or something that I felt was more real.
Really?
And that's how I made it my life.
Do either of you remember the first time that you covered a case and you saw a dead body? Like before the coroner got there and before everybody else got there, and what your reaction was to realizing that you were actually at a murder crime scene. Do you, either of you remember that?
Yes,
unfortunately,
I do. I was actually, I had two instances. I was interning at a Houston television station, and we went out to a home where there had been a murder, and the coroner had not gotten there yet, so I saw this. It was a white male, white, ashy guy. It was just really startling to me as a young reporter, but I was there with a veteran reporter who was able to kind of, you know, get me away from it. And, of course, I didn't want to get emotional or anything in front of him, so I was able to keep it in. And then there was a wreck here in Beaumont a few years ago where the bodies were pretty much dismembered, and I remember almost stepping, and this is gross, almost stepping on a finger, you know, that was strewn around the side of the highway. So that was pretty shocking because I'd never, ever seen anything like that in my life.
Changes you, and you don't forget that stuff, do you?
You don't. I can remember it like it was yesterday.
Natalie, when we read or watch crime stories, there's usually a response from the victim, if they survived, or in the case of murder, from the family members or neighbors. This is what we usually see on TV and read in the papers. Is this mm-hmm. the real substance of the crime story, the most important part?
I think the victim is usually the most important part of the story. And it's not just the actual crime, it's the follow-up. What happens to the family afterwards, who the victim leaves behind if they don't make it. And it's also the story that's most often ignored in regular media.
Really? Michelle, you've covered crime for 7 years, as we've said, in Texas. Mm-hmm. Before that, you worked at a newspaper. What are the main differences between crime reporting for television and crime reporting for the print media, let's say?
I think the immediacy of it, you know, if I go to a crime scene for television, I could go live within the hour. So I not only have to get to the crime scene, get all of the information, deal with the emotions that are surrounding the story, but I have to be ready to go on TV in within an hour live. And sometimes, you know, you do get very emotional depending on what's going on. And, you know, you have to kind of give yourself some time to get yourself together amidst everything that's going on.
Well, how do you
Whereas
do that?
Whereas a newspaper...
Mm-hmm, go on.
I'm sorry. Whereas a newspaper, you know, I could go back to the newsroom. I have several hours to write my story, and, you know, I'm not feeling as much pressure in such an emotional environment as I am with live television.
So when you're in a television situation, how do you collect yourself before you go on?
I think you just have to, you know, take a breather and put yourself in their shoes. And I remember one particular live shot that I did when a little girl had been murdered, actually taken from her home. And my news director told me that I was, you could tell that the story affected me, but it wasn't overboard. So the key is to be balanced about it. I mean, I'm not covering a happy story. I'm not covering anything that, you know, would make people laugh. So you have to be balanced in that you show that you're human. You show that you're affected by this as well as anybody would be. But you're also objective enough to stand there and give the facts and tell what's going on with the story.
Natalie, how do you go about approaching someone who was clearly upset or in shock at the time at a crime scene? How do you maintain a level of sensitivity, and how do you convey that to your readers? Do you want people crying, or do you want to be able to report that somebody had tears in their eyes? Does that make the story better?
No, it doesn't make the story better. I've had people say things like, you only put that detail in to sell newspapers, but I don't think I've ever sold another extra newspaper because of an extra detail. I put stuff like that in because it's going to affect the reader and change how they perceive it. When I go up to victims, I just go up as humbly and, you know, honestly as I can and say, do you want to talk to me? I've seen a lot of other journalists who are more pushy, and maybe that's more effective, but I think people sense sincerity and that you just want to tell their story.
In television, Michelle, they are pushier, mm-hmm. aren't they, at a crime scene?
Yeah, a little bit, although you learn as you mature that you really do have to put yourself in their shoes and how you would feel being interviewed. And my script is always, I know that this is a devastating time for you, but we would like you to be able to tell the viewers out there who this person was. We don't know him. We only know him as this murdered victim. But you know him as a brother or father or uncle, whoever, and we want you to tell the reader something about him. And normally that works because family members have a need to tell you about their loved ones, especially their loved ones that have just passed. And in TV, we want the emotion. We really want to get the screaming and howling, and we want to do it from a distance. You know, we don't want to put the camera in their face. But certainly it's something that we want to roll on because we want to show the anguish of this moment. We want to show the emotion.
Absolutely. Fascinating stuff. Thank you both for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michelle McCallop. She is a former crime reporter with KBMT Channel 12 in Beaumont, Texas. We also heard from Natalie Pompilio. She is a freelance journalist who has covered crime, wars, and natural disasters for 15 years. She joined us from Audio Post in Philadelphia. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. So before the break, we heard from two journalists about the process of crime reporting and the personal impact it can have on reporters as well as their viewers and readers. We're going now to continue this conversation on the psychological damage of crime reporting with Bruce Shapiro, the executive director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at the University of Washington. Welcome, Bruce.
Glad to be here.
Listen, what psychological damage can crime reporters suffer?
Well, I look, there's damage, there's risk, and there's also resilience. You know, reporters, by and large, are a resilient bunch. But psychologists for the last generation have been documenting with police and firefighters and EMTs and other first responders how a steady diet of exposure to tragedy and threat can have some psychological effects. And beginning a few years ago, psychologists began asking for the first time the same question about journalists. And it does turn out that depending on what kinds of stories folks cover, how long they cover it, and other issues, there can be some emotional fallout. And this may come as a surprise or as no surprise, but journalists tend to think of themselves as invulnerable, as objective, and as not affected by what they cover. So among general assignment reporters in the U.S., for instance, people who cover car accidents and fires and crime in particular, the sorts of stories that Natalie and Michelle were just describing, it turns out that, depending on the study, between 6% and 13% of reporters in American newsrooms will self-report the symptoms of or the descriptions of what turn out to be either post-traumatic stress disorder, a significant issue, or serious depression.
Now, there are many different roles in the newsroom, Bruce. Do you have to be out in the field to be traumatized by what you see and hear?
Not at all. In fact, and this is something that a lot of even news organizations don't think about, there's a profound phenomenon called vicarious traumatization, well documented. And this has to do with, again, a steady diet of images. In newsrooms, television newsrooms, for example, broadcast newsrooms, there's often a feed room, and there are people there whose job it is to watch the raw, unedited footage of a 9/11 or of the war in Gaza or of some huge natural disaster, Hurricane Katrina, who may sit there for an entire 8-hour shift watching images of horror. Those folks are at significant risk of PTSD or other emotional responses, and sometimes that can be quite disabling. I know one person at a major newsroom in London who had a truly disabling brush with PTSD that was brought on by a steadily processing those images,
those
unedited images from the early Iraq war. It can happen to any of us, and this is toxic material at times for journalists.
Bruce, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
That was Bruce Shapiro. He is the executive director at the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at the University of Washington. How is crime reporting changing, though, and what role will new journalism play in putting an end to the "if it bleeds, it leads" editorial decision-making? To explain more on that, we have Jane Stevens. She is a multimedia journalist and co-director of the Violence Reporting Project at the Berkeley Media Studies Group. Jane, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks, Tony. Nice to be here.
So how does this project, this work, and who can get involved in this reporting project that you're involved with?
Well, hopefully any journalist who wants to at this point, because it is web-based and we are moving into this modern world where we can actually report crime in a community a little bit better than we have been. And what I mean by that is that although journalists have been doing a really good job reporting individual crimes, we've actually been missing the story about crime and how it affects a community, and especially violent crime, because that's what we mostly cover. And so I really want to modernize crime reporting, take a prevention approach to reporting and crime. And
what does that mean, prevention approach? What does that mean?
Well, the web lets us do something that we haven't been able to do before, which is really take a solution-oriented and contextual approach to reporting on crime, focusing on the issues that are costing the community the most economically and emotionally, and follow through with that until the issues are resolved or the goals are met. So, in essence, I want to take a sports approach to reporting violence in a community. And that means, why don't I take it the other way? So say that you took a crime reporting approach to covering your local NFL team. And if you did that, you would only report on the games that had the highest scores, the lowest scores, perhaps the games that had the most people, the fewest people, and you may not report anything much beyond that. And you might report the last game if it seems significant, but you wouldn't really have any idea of if the team was doing well, or if it was doing poorly, what it needed to do to get better, if it was having a losing season. The goal is really there is to have the team have a winning season. So in this approach to violence reporting, what I would like to do is to look at the data, and what you'll find is that we actually aren't reporting the kinds of crime that are affecting the community the most. And where we found that, interestingly enough, was almost every metropolitan daily. For example, We went to San Jose Mercury News, and we counted all the types of aggravated assaults that occurred in a three-month time period, and we looked at what San Jose had covered. Now, we knew that of those 1,000 aggravated assaults that had happened, I would say about 80% of those were domestic violence-related, because there's a pretty good domestic violence prevention program going on in Santa Clara County, where San Jose is. And then we looked at what San Jose had covered in terms of stories about aggravated assault, and they had 5 stories, and none of them were domestic violence.
Well, let me stop you there to ask you this, because our time is running short. It would seem that from a content standpoint, that what you are trying to do perhaps is admirable, but it doesn't seem like good TV, and that would be something you would have a difficult time getting on television. Can you give me a brief response to that?
Well, I think all of our news organizations are morphing over to be web-based. If you take this approach, there's no reason why you can't still have that individual story that is the marker for what is really happening in community. So in this case, if San Jose is spending half of its budget on emergency response in all sorts of ways to dealing with domestic violence, then you could highlight a really interesting domestic violence story and have that represent what is going on in that area. And more importantly, the web lets you actually engage the community to figure out solutions.
All right,
and that's what we journalists have to do, is to enable that.
Unfortunately, our time is out. I appreciate it, but we'll have to end it there. Thank you very much, Jane.
Thanks, Tony.
That was Jane Stevens, a multimedia journalist and co-director of the Violence Reporting Project at the Berkeley Media Studies Group. She joined us from the studios of KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. Every other Friday here on the show, we bring in Newsweek magazine's Allison Samuels to bring us up to speed on the latest in entertainment news. I know you've heard her, but now you will actually be hearing a whole lot more of Allison. She's going to be joining us on the show until March 20th, far more frequently and with a new twist. She'll be asking the questions instead of giving the answers. Allison, look at you smiling. How are you feeling about this new role here on News and Notes? We are excited about having you like that.
I'm excited, too. It gives me more time to do, you know, more interesting stories that I can't always do at Newsweek, and, you know, just more time to spend with you guys.
Okay, well, you know, we love that. Now, I understand, to get this thing rolling, that this next segment was inspired by something that you actually saw as you were driving down the street here in Los Angeles. What was that?
As I was driving down the street, I kept seeing billboards for "He's Just Not That Into You." And I was really struck by the billboards being so non-diverse. Everyone on the billboard was, you know, Drew Barrymore or Jennifer Aniston, but no people of color. And it started me to thinking of, in the day of Obama, is it politically correct to have movies like that? And interestingly enough, Entertainment Weekly announced on the cover its current issue, quote, "Obama is changing pop culture forever," end quote. So I sat down with Sean Smith, the Los Angeles bureau chief of Entertainment Weekly, about how he thinks this change is coming. I started off by asking him about the casting and the marketing of "He's Just Not That Into You."
Yeah, it's ultra white, that cast. It looks like it was cast in Wisconsin. But yeah, I think it is going to change. And it's going to change, I think, for several reasons. Among them, Hollywood has to think about what is reaching the younger audience and being popular. And the world that "He's Just Not That Into You" exists in is not the world that an 18-year-old in America lives in now. Mm-hmm. Also, you look at those crowds on election night in Grant Park and on Inauguration Day, and that's what America looks like.
Right.
And when you have that kind of popularity for a president or any sort of cultural figure, it automatically shifts. And I think the studios start to look at that and go, okay, how do we reach that audience? How do we reach those people? And how do we tap into that enthusiasm? That's their job, to figure out how to do it. I think you'll probably see it first in television before you see it in film, but okay, I think it'll be a longer process for film, yeah.
Because when you think about that movie, a movie about love and relationships, a minority could have easily been weaved into that. I mean, that has no color line. So even before Obama, why would you think they'd make a movie like that just didn't recognize the fact that love is sort of universal?
People always say there's not overt racism in Hollywood, but it's everywhere, which is that it's this kind of passive thing where they just aren't. I honestly think in a situation like that, they just weren't thinking about it in that respect. Or a script goes out to all of these agencies and they give it to all of their top talent. All their top talent, with the exception of people like Will Smith, happens to be white. Right. And so you sort of, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that way. Unless someone steps outside and says, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should actually have a little pigment in this movie.
Right.
It doesn't happen automatically.
In your current spread of Entertainment Weekly, and the quote is Obama's crew, you have all these people who have a lot of power. Tom Hanks, Michael Linden from Sunny, Jeffrey Katzenberg. Do you think these people will have any impact on how things change in Hollywood? I mean, they have the power, right, to make a difference.
They absolutely do have the power, and I think it will. I mean, and here's what has been fascinating to me. You've got a situation now. Oprah's the most powerful woman in television. Will Smith is the most powerful actor in film. In fact, he is kind of the only movie star we have that's consistently bankable. You've got Barack Obama, who's president of the United States, and yet there really has not been the kind of trickle-down effect you would expect. Okay. I think Barack has an incredibly huge impact on that, though, because, A, he is so charismatic. He is not just another president. He has become really the first 21st century global pop icon, and that has a huge impact. Because it changes the idea of what power looks like, of what intelligence looks like, about what sexy looks like, all of those things. Michelle Obama does the same thing. And so that cannot help but begin to permeate into the culture. And yes, these people, these really powerful people like the Geffens and Katzenbergs and Oprahs and all of those people really can have a huge impact on how African-Americans are cast and people of color are cast in film and television.
You have Tyler Perry, who makes many movies, two or three a year. But what does the Obama effect have on his kind of movies? Because his movies are sort of lowbrow in some ways. Obama being this sort of powerful, sort of very intelligent, good-looking man, does that change the type of movies Hollywood does in terms of just sort of the nuances of them, do you think?
I think so. I mean, Tyler Perry is speaking to a very specific demographic, and I don't know that that's going to change. And he is, in fact, sort of operating outside of the big studio system. His movies are released through Lionsgate, and he's not really dealing with a major studio. Mm-hmm. I don't know that's going to change his. The problem has been is that he's been one of the very few, especially for African-American women, he's been one of the very few places where African-American women characters are seen on screen. And I think what's going to change here is that you're going to see the diversity of roles begin to expand in all kinds of movies. So I think I don't know if it's going to change the humor of it. I mean, it is shocking, I think, in some ways. You talk about the billboard thing. You drive around Los Angeles and you see that billboard for He's Just Not That Into You, and right next to it is the billboard for Madea goes to jail.
Right, right.
And that contrast
is amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Jarring. It's very jarring. I mean, and that's what got me. I'm just sort of like, I don't really want to see either one of them in some ways. I'm just sort of going, isn't there a middle ground here that we can get to? Now, at Sundance, Push was a huge hit.
Yeah, huge.
It's a bleak story about a morbidly obese pregnant teenager. The critics loved it, but what kind of box office draw do you think it will actually get?
It's a hard sell for a box office draw. Just naturally, but if it gets the kind of critical support it needs, you can have a situation like with Monsters Ball or Monster, where you don't. I mean, look, no one wants to go. Most people don't want to go see a really somber, really depressing, upsetting movie like that. It's really bleak, that movie.
Yes, it is.
But if you start hearing buzz about Monique getting a Best Supporting Actress nomination, if there's that kind of critical support and it gets an Oscar push, then I think. You'll see it sort of, but I don't imagine that movie will ever gross more than $25 million.
Well, that's wonderful. It's a wonderful segue into the Oscar category because you have two African-American women that are nominated, Taraji Henson and Viola Davis. Any predictions?
I think it's going to go to Viola. And and what's exciting to me about that is because they put Kate Winslet's performance for The Reader in lead, it puts her up against Meryl Streep as opposed to up against Viola Davis, which is what she was going to be.
Okay.
And it really helps Viola's chances, I think.
Okay.
Taraji is fantastic, but it's a much more subtle performance, I think.
Yeah.
Viola has that one amazing scene with Meryl Streep standing there in the cold with the tears running down her cheeks. And, and it's just, and it's also, that's such a lived-in performance. You feel, in one scene, you sense that is a life that has been lived by that woman. So I have a feeling it's going to go to Viola. That's my prediction.
Thank you very much, Sean.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That was Entertainment Weekly's Los Angeles Bureau Chief, Sean Smith. He joined us in our studios of NPR West in Culver City, California.